Welcome back, everyone, to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. And we're pleased to have David Nichols with us today from University of Virginia to talk about gravitational wave memory effects. Welcome, David, and please take it from here.
Well, great. Thank you very much for that nice introduction and also for the opportunity to give a talk here at Perimeter Institute. It's nice to be back, at least virtually, since last time I was here, it was a few years ago. As I guess a thing of bookkeeping, you know, I'm happy if people have questions at any point just to jump in. I probably won't, you know, monitor any chat questions or hands up. So, you know, the easiest way is just to chime in if you have a question. All right, so let me then just begin by giving a brief outline of what I'll tell you about today. So there are just 5 points here. I'll give you a brief status update of what's going on in terms of the detections of gravitational waves from binary black holes. Then I'll go over what the memory effect is and what its detection prospects are. The third point will be discussing, you know, what we'll learn in terms of fundamental physics from detecting the gravitational wave memory effect. And then I'll discuss how sort of these issues about the implications actually led to the discovery of new types of memory effects. And I'll discuss, you know, when we might be able to detect these as well. And I'll then wrap up. So just so that everyone is on the same page, I think you've probably heard a fair amount about the LIGO and Virgo detectors recently, but they're built, they're operational, and they're detecting gravitational waves. Probably the most interesting twist to this story is that COGRA has recently joined the collaboration of LIGO and Virgo, and it will begin operating somewhere at a sensitivity where it can also contribute to detecting gravitational waves soon. So the basic principle of gravitational wave detection is familiar. If a gravitational wave comes from top of the screen, it causes this relative stretching and squeezing of the arms of the detector. This leads to light leaking out into the dark part of the interferometer, which then can be calibrated into a strain. And while this sounds simple, it's of course a very challenging experimental effort to get to the sensitivities required to detect gravitational waves. Some representative sensitivities are shown in this bottom plot here. It's always, you know, an amazing experimental achievement just to think about the fact that these kilometer scale detectors are measuring strains at their peak sensitivity of around 100 hertz of, you know, 10 to the minus 3, or in some rough sense, the noise fluctuations at that frequency are, you know, around 10 to the minus 19 meters. So that's always something remarkable to remember in this game. The other remarkable thing to remember is that even with this extreme sensitivity, the gravitational waves actually reach the Earth from far out in distant galaxies are actually, you know, quite weak. So the searches still need to be templated to get to find the most gravitational waves. And for binary black holes, the templates that you're most familiar with, you know, are these so-called in-spiral merger ring down templates, where there's a slow growth in amplitude and the frequency of oscillation over time. It then peaks around the point of merger as the two black holes merge, and then the system rings down in a set of exponentially damped modes, which are the characteristic oscillation frequencies of a vacuum curved black hole. So through the details of how this frequency and amplitude evolve, one can actually get precise information about what the masses and spins of the black holes are that collided, and then also information about the mass of the final black hole, either through measuring this in isolation or through using numerical relativity. So I won't go into the details.
Question. Mm-hmm. Hi, David. Could you go back to the noise curves, the one before? So do we have a noise curve for CAGRA?
I don't have one at the moment, but I think it's, you know, somewhere pretty high up in this range.
I see.
So it's not at the point where it can contribute yet to gravitational wave detection, but they're obviously working hard, and I think we'll get there quite soon.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, so then for the detection, what has been detected, it's nicely summarized in this plot where the horizontal axis has no meaning, but the vertical axis shows the total mass of the merged black hole, so at the endpoint of every arrow, and then the pair of black holes that form this final black hole. So as you can see, we're now beginning to have a sense of what the population of binary black holes that's merging in our universe is, just from these first three observing runs. And to give you a flavor of how this field is picking up, the first observing run, which was 3 months, had 3 detections. The second, which was 9 months, had 7 binary black hole detections, and this first binary neutron star detection. And then in the first half of the third observing run, a period of about 6 months, the detectors increased sensitivity significantly, and it's gone up to 36 binary black holes, another binary neutron star, and then a few quite interesting objects, which it's quite hard to determine if it's a black hole, binary black hole, or black hole neutron star. Depends on your ideas of what the maximum or mass of a neutron star is. Okay, so there's a lot of things one can take from this plot. What I'll focus on in this talk is what one can learn about strong gravity, since this is indeed the strong gravity seminar. So to do this, I like to show this plot of gravitational wave luminosity on the vertical axis, which I've plotted in units of the Planck luminosity, namely the speed of light to the fifth over g, or the unique luminosity you can construct from these constants in h bar. So you can see h bar doesn't actually contribute here. And then what I'm showing on the horizontal axis is it's my favorite measure of nonlinearity. So it's basically something like a dimensionless version of the Newtonian potential. So if you're at somewhere around 1, it means your binary has got so close that it's collapsed and formed a single black hole. All right, so let's just give sort of a few characteristic points on this plot. I have my favorite object in the solar system, Mercury and the Sun, which of course was important for confirming or being an experimental verification of Einstein's theory of relativity, in the sense that this anomalous precession that couldn't be explained through Newtonian physics was nicely explained through Einstein's relativity. But in terms of luminosity, this is not a very luminous system. It's radiating about a watt of gravitational wave power if you naively use the quadrupole formula. So it was only many years later when binary neutron stars were discovered, so a new class of system, that there was actually considerable evidence for the emission of gravitational waves through the slow change in the orbital parameters of this binary pulsar. And the system for the astronomers is radiating somewhere about a solar luminosity in gravitational waves. So just as you wouldn't ever hope to detect gravitational waves from Mercury and the Sun, discovering a new class of system finally allowed one to learn much more about Einstein's theory of general relativity. So for binary black holes, there's a new sort of step of comparable magnitude going from these binary pulsars to the luminosity that you get from these binary black holes, where you might be close to a few thousandths of the Planck luminosity. And as a result, just as how you wouldn't expect to measure gravitational waves from Mercury and the Sun, there's going to be a class of gravitational phenomena that you wouldn't expect to measure from binary pulsars. And namely, it's these phenomena that occur specifically for very high luminosities. The space-time is quite dynamical, and by this measure, about as nonlinear as it can get. All right, so what is one such phenomena? The focus of this talk will be the gravitational wave memory effect. And if you're not familiar with it, the gravitational wave memory is just this relatively simple phenomenon where you may be used to gravitational waves like the red sketch drawn here, which start at zero and then end at zero after the waves have passed. But in fact, in Einstein's theory, most gravitational wave sources that are transient will be more like the blue source, will they? In which they'll oscillate and then settle to a non-zero value, delta H, at late times. So what would this mean in terms of an idealized interferometer, like an idealized version of LIGO? Well, like in the movie I showed, before the waves, you'd have no light coming out of the dark port, and the arms would be equal length, but they'd stretch and squeeze as the waves pass, but it would return in time five here to the original state it was at time one. However, when you have the memory effect for this idealized interferometer, the initial state that you're in for the interferometer will differ from the final state. So in other words, if you had an idealized interferometer, there would be some light coming out of the dark port, which would remain after the waves have passed. So, you know, essentially it comes because there's a lasting change in the proper distance that happens along these arms of the interferometer. Or another way of thinking about it is that, you know, there's a difference in your standards that you use for measuring distances before and after the waves. So one could, in principle, remove this effect at late times, but then at early times, you would have had light coming out of the interferometer if you had used the same standards. Okay, so like I said, this is a generic prediction of general relativity. So what then produces this memory effect? And I have this schematic equation where I have three types of sources that produce this lasting strain, delta H. One which I'll explain in more detail later, which I'm calling for now changes in conserved quantities, which sounds a bit contradictory. But to have a sense of what kinds of sources produce this, you can think about things that, like black holes or neutron stars scattering on unbound orbits. So massive particles where two time derivatives of the quadrupole in the system change from early to late times. This was, of course, discovered quite some time ago. The other source, or two kinds of sources, rely on this integral over time. So it relies sort of on the history of the emission. And there's two classes of emission. They're both, you know, related to emission from massless fields. And the prototypical example that people think of is when a supernova explodes, you have some energy radiated in neutrinos. They're one of the dominant sources of energy that that carries off energy from the system. And although they're not strictly massless, at least when they're discovered, that was a good when this effect was discovered, that was a good approximation. But you know, to very good approximation, you can treat them as massless. And essentially, asymmetries in this energy flux per solid angle, when integrated over time, are another source of gravitational wave memory effect. And it was only later that it was realized that an analogous kind of phenomenon can occur for gravitational waves. So there's an effective stress energy per solid angle arising from gravitational wave emission. And that effective stress energy, you know, radiates and produces this memory effect just as, you know, a real stress energy tensor would. And this was, you know, something discovered by Christodoulou and computed independently by Wanche and Dumour. All right. So let me just give you a bit of intuition about, you know, how the memory works for Newtonian kinds of systems. So if you just have a compact binary, which has some separation A, and you want to observe the memory effect at some distance far away R from the system, you can do a calculation and you'd find that your expectations for what the memory are consistent with energy balance. That, in other words, if you have some widely separated binary and it moves closer together, it would have had to change its Newtonian potential energy, which is this delta of the quantity in brackets here. But it turns out as it's radiated in some non-trivial profile or sky pattern, maybe is a better way to put it. And this, you know, non-trivial sky pattern leads to this production of this memory effect, this lasting strain, which I have chosen to be in the plus polarization in the basis that I'm using here. Okay. But then the question is, you know, how large is this effect and when is it dominant? Well, obviously the Newtonian in spiral is a relatively weak portion of the signal. So what I'm showing in this plot here is a recent numerical simulation by Mittman and his collaborators. And what's shown sort of is the slow growth is how the memory grows during the long in spiral. And then right around the time of merger and ring down, there's a rapid increase, which leads to a much higher value for this memory effect than you would expect based just on the Newtonian expectations that I've described here. So there's one, you know, interesting subtle point. You might notice there's actually two curves. There's one, which is H20, and that's computed exactly to the numerical resolution of the simulations by evolving the waves all the way out to null infinity. And then there's this interesting second term, which is called delta J. And this delta J is computed using the approximate method that I showed on the previous slide in terms of this kind of balance law. And they agree very well. So throughout this talk, I'll, when I do my forecasts and so on, I'll always use this approximate method, which can make use of existing waveforms that don't always capture the memory very precisely. All right, so let's then think about the detectability of this memory effect. So you're familiar with this in-spiral merger and ring down signal, and most of the templates that LIGO and Virgo use don't have the memory effect included. They are zero mean. So if you extend it to past infinity, minus time minus infinity, this would be zero, and it goes to zero at late times. But as we saw from this previous simulation, there actually is this additional effect that ramps up and goes to a non-zero value, producing the memory. So this is a signal one can, in principle, measure, and there's sort of two strategies that one might use to try to detect it. So the first strategy is, you know, the true waveform with memory will include both this zero mean part and this non-zero mean part, and it'll look something like this for a typical system like the 150914 system. So as you can see, it's a relatively small fraction of the total peak amplitude. You know, characteristically, it might be around a 20th or so. So there's two approaches that one can take to try to measure the memory effect. One can do a kind of hypothesis test where one looks at the hypothesis that the data is best described by this complete waveform, or it's best described by this waveform that doesn't have any memory. And one can do this for real events. But for what I'll describe in this talk, it's a little easier to take a different approach, which is to just say the second signal here, the part just associated with the memory, it's some, you know, time domain signal that would have some signal to noise in the LIGO data stream. So one can just estimate how much this would stand out above the noise by computing the signal to noise ratio just of this, you know, additional part associated with the memory. So for the forecasts that I do here, this is the strategy that I'll take. Okay, so let me then jump to the results. So I'll first focus on whether it's possible to detect this with advanced LIGO or not. And what I'm showing here is, you know, the signal to noise just for the memory part of the signal for a binary that ranges between sort of 10 and, you know, several hundred solar masses, which is in LIGO's most sensitive range. And this is, you know, what I consider to be a conservative estimate because I'm considering just a single LIGO detector. I'm not assuming any preferred orientation. I'm averaging over all the possible angles, you know, so position on the sky, polarization of the waves, and orientation of the binary with respect to line of sight. And then I'm seeing, you know, how far out you can sort of measure the memory effect for a given mass. And as you can see, these yellowish colored stars here are the masses and distances, say median values of the detections found so far. And as you can see, this contour here of about 0.3 means that, you know, all the events detected so far, the signal to noise is, you know, quite a bit less than one. And because the rate of these events goes with the volume, getting something, you know, a factor of a few closer in volume means we might have to wait very many years until we could see an event signal to noise of order three, which you can think of for this purpose as being something like a three sigma significant detection of the memory.
David, just a quick question. So in this exercise, are you assuming that you're trying, or are you using as much information as you can from the mean spiral on the pre-memory stuff to trigger when to look, the strength to look, or are you leaving more freedom there?
So I'm doing this plot is just doing the very naive thing. So I'm just taking the median values. So this at least for these stars here, and then for the colors and contours, I'm assuming then that you know the masses as well as possible. If you didn't, then there would be some distribution of signal to noise around each of these points. So I'm not sure if I properly answered your question here, but
the only thing I'm trying to ask is, are you looking for the memory with as much information as you can extracted from the previous stage, from the spiral merger and ring down?
That's right. So in some sense, that would play into what the criteria you use for considering the detection. So I'm assuming you have a confirmed detection of the signal so that you can then use, say, the so that you don't have to do sort of a separate search. You assume that there is this indeed the signal, and then the residual part should be the memory effect associated with that signal. So in that sense, yes, I'm using as much information as I can.
Thank you.
Okay. So anyway, even with using as much information as one can, it looks like one won't be able to detect the memory, at least from an individual event. So there's sort of two strategies then one can think of taking. One can wait around for the more advanced detectors like the Einstein telescope. So this is a 10 kilometer scale detector underground, and it will hopefully be operational sometime in the 2030s. The US has an independent plan of building sort of an object that's basically 10 times the scale of LIGO called Cosmic Explorer. And from these noise curves, the blue is the LIGO noise curve, green and pink are Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, respectively. So as you can see, these detectors are at least a factor of 10 better in terms of sensitivity, and quite a bit better at low frequencies. So one can then repeat this analysis and say, how loud would the memory effect be in these future detectors, which is what I've done here. So in the bottom, I have Einstein Telescope, and in the top, I have Cosmic Explorer. So as you can see, particularly for Cosmic Explorer, one can expect events sort of on average where the signal to noise might be as high as in the tens. And in the best case scenario, if we have two Cosmic Explorers and an Einstein Telescope, this may be as high as in the 20 or 30. So we might be able to do sort of relatively high precision studies of the gravitational wave memory effect with these future observatories. So I'll also mention, since I found out this is also the Canada-LISA meeting is occurring at the same time, I should at least say something about LISA, although probably the people who are most interested in this aren't here. So for those of you who don't know much about LISA, it's space-based interferometer, which will launch in the 2030s. It'll operate for several years, and it's most sensitive to millihertz gravitational waves due to its much larger length scale of million kilometer arms. So it's most sensitive to supermassive binary black hole mergers. And one can then say, to what redshift, to what cosmological distance can one actually detect this gravitational wave memory effect for different masses? So the same exercise. And the idea is, if you have some system that's around 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, you can detect it to signal to noise around 5, all the way up to a redshift of a few. So This, of course, looks much more promising. Unfortunately, I'm not able to put any dots on this plot because we don't know very much about the, observationally at least, about the population of emergent supermassive black holes. But there's a number of calculations that have been done, and one expects that there might be sort of a order one, let's say, supermassive binary black hole merger that would happen during a 4 to 10 year LISA mission lifetime. So LISA is also a promising avenue for measuring the memory from a single event.
David, do you mind if I interrupt?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
So something that we've been sort of talking about recently is the following. So currently we have templates that are good enough to do searches with LIGO and, measure parameters with LIGO. But as we go to third generation detectors, those templates are going to be probably not good enough, right? So all the unknown stuff that we still haven't put into the templates will become important. And that might mean that, we're going to be limited in how well we can do things with third generation detectors unless we can overcome those systematic problems. So what I was wondering now is, so if you go after the memory, but using templates that are not fully adequate, could there be a danger that other things that should be there in the template might actually, be degenerate somehow with memory type things? I mean, it looks unlikely first sight because, it's mostly an amplitude effect, whereas most stuff that you care about in templates are going to be phase factors. But have you thought about this?
So I haven't investigated this in any detail. I agree that in principle, there could be some overlap between a memory signal and, whatever you're not modeling properly in numerical relativity. I think for the arguments that you gave, it's going to be a relatively small effect. But, for these kinds of plots that I'm making here, I'm sort of assuming that numerical relativity has also improved greatly in the subsequent decade so that these issues don't become problematic. But I agree, in principle, there could be some overlap and that could, in principle, bias your result that maybe your memory template picks up some of the unmodeled or not properly modeled part of your numerical relativity waveform template. But I haven't quantified this in any, in any complete way at all.
Yeah. No, but anyway, I'm glad you thought about that. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, let me then think about what one might do to try to detect the memory sooner. So to do this, there was an interesting proposal by Paul Lasky and collaborators where they thought about trying to detect the memory effect in a population of binary black holes. So the approach that they took is they essentially computed a signal-to-noise statistic, which is the sum of all the individual signals-to-noise, the memory signals in quadrature. And then they generated multiple populations. They did this of a relatively simple population of just detections like the first event, because they did it immediately after the first detection. And they found this very interesting result that if you have this population just like the first event, where in terms of masses and distances, but you just let the orientations and positions on the sky vary, and you generate many realizations of these populations as shown in these gray curves, then on average, if you average over these different populations, you tend to accumulate, say 3 to 5 significant detection of the memory effect and not so many detections, right? So for 3, it's somewhere on the order of 30, and for 5, it's somewhere on the order of 90 events, let's say. The two curves here are, related to a very subtle point about to do this coherent adding of signals. You need to have some measurement of more than just the quadrupole mode of the waves. And that's, obviously not possible for all events because these octupole and higher multipole moments are suppressed. But it turns out that, from this study, it looked quite optimistic based on this simplified population of events just like the first one. So I revisited the study with a master's student, Oliver Boersma and Patricia Schmidt, and we used a much more realistic population of binary black holes. So the one that was actually inferred from the O1 and O2 events by the LIGO collaboration. But we otherwise repeated the study that Lasky et al. Did and computed the signal-to-noise statistic. And we were interested in the question of how many years of actual wall time. So if this were 2022, this would be 2027, how many years of actual wall time would it take for the detector to get a 3-sigma significant detection, assuming here a 50% duty cycle that the detectors are not operational all the time. They're only coincident half the time. So it looks less optimistic that it'll take more like on the order of 5 years of detector operation to actually achieve a signal to noise where you might contain have a significant detection of the memory effect. So let's see. Yeah, so in other words, what this means is that subsequently after we did this paper, it's most likely that advanced LIGO will not operate 5 years, but there will be some intermediate stage called advanced LIGO A+. So it's most likely sort of in the A+ era of the LIGO detectors that will have a reasonable shot at getting statistical evidence for the memory in a population. Okay, I thought I might have seen a hand up, but is there a question?
Yeah, I have a question. I think it's a nice question that's going to show that my level of ignorance and signal to noise ratio, but I wanted to understand a little bit more what hypothesis is needed in order to get this improvement. And when you say population, you have to assume some homogeneity in terms of the event. What is really going on behind this mechanism? Is it purely statistical, or there's extra layers of understanding you need to put in?
I mean, it's just saying that in each individual event, the memory is below thresholds. So you can't claim a confident detection. But if you have a number of these small sub-threshold signals, and if you compare all these small sub-threshold signals versus the hypothesis that noise is just randomly adding up in a way to look like memory, and what the signal to noise is saying is that you actually do have some evidence that it looks like there's a number of these sub-threshold signals that are piling up rather than just a bunch of random noise realizations that might mimic signal. So it's a statistical trick.
Why is there a difference then between your analysis and the one before? Where is that?
It's really this assumption of the population. So the population that Lasky et al. Considered was quite simple in the sense that they really took the first event, they took the distance at which it occurred, and then they took the most probable masses for this binary, and then they made a population of events that were just distributed over a spherical shell in the sky at that distance with random orientations with respect to the detector. So here we're allowing the masses of the binary to differ in a way that's consistent with the LIGO observations. We're allowing the distances to vary, and then we're still having these random orientations of the binary on the sky. So we're we have a much more astrophysically consistent population of black holes, and unfortunately that means there just aren't that. I mean, from the observations, there just aren't that many systems like the first event that was a bit of an outlier in terms of how loud and how massive it was and how close it was. So it just takes longer, basically. Okay. So this is, sort of the picture of detection. So one can see it's going to be challenging to detect the memory effect. So the question then, is it worth it? Sort of what does one learn? And then I'll change direction a bit at this point and talk a bit about the theoretical implications. And to do this, I'd like to mention a bit about asymptotically flat spacetimes and their symmetries. So I promise this will, you know, connect in a few slides. So the way to think about asymptotically flat spacetimes is there's sort of two approaches, one due to Bondi and one due to Penrose. Penrose diagrams are obviously sort of the nicer ones, which are depicted here. You know, this is literally a Penrose diagram in the sense that it's drawn by Penrose here. And what's drawn here is light cones heading out from the interior of the spacetime, and then they end at a limit as R goes to infinity, which has been brought to a finite point through a conformal transformation of the spacetime. And this null hypersurface, this, you know, furthest cone out here, is what's called future null infinity. And it's convenient to parameterize it in terms of retarded time u, and then some two angles on these cross sections of constant u, which, you know, look like a circle, but are actually two spheres since one dimension is suppressed. And as usual, time is running up in this diagram. And one can ask the question, you know, what are the set of symmetries that preserve this null surface at infinity? And it turns out there's sort of two components. There's two functions that determine these symmetries. One, which is the so-called supertranslation symmetry, which is a scalar independent of retarded time. And then a second, a vector field Y, which is a Lorentz transformation in terms of these variables. So there, it turns out there's six of these vectors corresponding to the three rotations and three boosts as a basis of these YA. So the transformations, the supertranslations, they just shift your retarded time by some constant amount alpha, which can vary depending on the angle. So to illustrate what these transformations are, it's useful to expand them in spherical harmonics and then think about the few lowest harmonics. So to do this, I'll take one of these light cones here in flat spacetime and then just apply a constant shift at every angle up along retarded time. And as you can see in the spacetime diagram, the effect of this is to basically, you know, translate both the cross section null infinity, but also the vertex of the light cone by a constant amount in time. And the second set of simplest transformations you can impose are the dipole ones. And these dipoles, you know, obviously shift some points to the future in terms of retarded time and some to the past. But they do so in such a way that in flat space time, if you trace back all the light rays, they still intersect in a point. And the point is just shifted by some amount. So this is one way one can interpret these as some kind of translation. But it turns out that there's, you know, obviously quadrupole and much higher multiple moments that one can apply. And these transformations have the property that at least in flat space, they no longer preserve the fact that these light rays intersect at a point. They just intersect, you know, at different times and at different locations when you apply these transformations. So in flat space time, you might, you know, want to consider the set of symmetries that preserve the fact that your light cone meets in a point. But in asymptotically flat spacetimes, where you might have something like a binary black hole going around here, there's not really any reason to preserve this condition. So you have this infinite set of symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetimes. Okay, let me then remind you of, you know, a second feature of what happens when you have a symmetry. Well, Noether's theorem says that whenever there is such a continuous symmetry of an action, there's a corresponding conserved quantity. So for the Bondi-Metzner-Sachs group associated with these Lorentz symmetries, there is, of course, you know, seven familiar conserved quantities, energy, linear momentum, and angular momentum. There's the Lorentz boost, where in which people usually ignore the conserved quantity, but it's non-trivial in general. So there's some center of mass angular momentum, which you can think of as something like a mass dipole or mass times the center of mass position in the rest frame of the source. But what's most interesting for the memory is that these supertranslations mean there's an infinite number of additional conserved quantities which get called supermomenta, because there's in some sense a generalization of normal translation, and the generalization then is this supermomentum as a conserved quantity. So there's one subtlety. So normally when you think of Noether's theorem, there's these charges are conserved, they're a constant, but when you actually have something like a surface like null infinity where gravitational waves can pass through it and change your charges, this can lead to a net flux of these quantities. So your charges are not conserved in the sense that they're being constant, but they're conserved in the sense that their change is equal to some flux of that charge through null infinity. Okay, so then, let me revisit this schematic equation, which I wrote before. So this equation that I wrote down actually is just the statement of supermomentum conservation. So the changes in my conserved quantities are the supermomentum. And then the flux sort of has two parts. There's a part that's nonlinear in the strain and nonlinear in your massless fields, and then a part that's linear in your strain. And the point then is that, the memory as I've computed here is just enforcing the fact that, you need to have this conserved supermomentum balance law in asymptotically flat space times, and you need to have the memory effect occurring for this to hold. So that's in fact precisely how I was computing these memory waveforms, was by requiring supermomentum balance to hold at every time. When I was computing it from waveforms that didn't satisfy supermomentum balance. Okay, so there's then a number of interesting things that can happen from measuring the memory. I mean, just sort of on the most basic level, it says that, this energy per solid angle carried in gravitational waves in this effective stress energy tensor, really radiates and produces secondary gravitational waves like any, matter source. I mean, I think, at least for me, it's of interest that, this supermomentum conservation would apply to binary black hole mergers. And, in computing this, I've assumed that the final state is a Kerr black hole, but if it had some, weird supermomentum hair or something, then this would change the memory. So you can learn a fair amount about relativity. And then the final interesting and somewhat subtle point, which I didn't, explain very clearly, is that this is also directly related to the symmetries, in the sense that if you think of what is the preferred rest frame at early times and then the preferred rest frame at late times, these will generically not be the same. The amplitude of the memory, tells you in some sense what the super translation is between these, preferred initial and final states, before and after the waves pass. So there's a lot of very interesting physics that one can then learn from measuring the memory effect, both in terms of symmetries, boundary conditions, and properties of the final remnant. Okay, and one final point that I'd like to make is that actually this viewpoint of thinking about memory as related to symmetries and conserved quantities led to sort of finding new kinds of memory effects. So I'll mention that there were that, more recently, say in the past decade-ish or so, there were, proposals for extended symmetry groups of null infinity, where the vector fields, Lorentz vector fields, so those which, are tangent or preserve a given cut, it was proposed that there might be, larger symmetry groups that are physically interesting. So there are two such proposals. One is that these vector fields Y, instead of thinking of the globally defined ones, which are the Lorentz transformations, one thinks of all the vector fields which are just locally defined and which may have, singular points on the sphere. So that was this Barnich and Trosser proposal. And there is a second proposal about considering, instead of just Lorentz vector fields, just all the diffeomorphisms of these two sphere cross sections, and trying to understand, what are the conserved quantities associated with these extended symmetries. And you can define conserved charges, which are sometimes called super Lorentz charges, or if you think about them in terms of the center of mass and spin parts, they're split into these two parts. So there's a super center of mass and super spin. So since there is this nice relationship between conserved quantities and memory effects, it's natural to ask, are there memory effects related to these extended symmetries? And are they in principle measurable? And the answer to both these questions is yes, although it will be challenging to measure some of these more subtle memory effects. Just as one additional subtle point, is there a sense in which for systems like binary black holes that one can think of the initial and final frames as being, super Lorentz transformed? In that case, the answer is no. So, these memory effects, don't have as close a connection with symmetries as the standard memory effect does for the BMS supertranslations. But I think it's still interesting just that there are these, new memory effects that have been found due to thinking about things in terms of conserved quantities at null infinity. Okay, so let me just describe these two memory effects. The first is the one related to these super spin charges. So if you write out a schematic equation for, this balance law, it has a similar form, except there's one interesting feature that the memory effect doesn't appear in the gravitational wave strain, it appears in its time integral. But the structure is quite similar. The change in this time integrated strain is related to changes in the charges plus these two kinds of flux terms. So one can get changes in these charges. One such scenario where it occurs is if you have unbound spinning objects that scatter, there can be some net sort of change in the angle of the spins, which produces this relative angle of the spins that produces this change in the superspin charges. For these matter fields, I think it's conceivable that one might detect them from something like a core collapse that's rotating, where the neutrinos actually carry some orbital angular momentum. Although, I don't know of any quantitative calculation of this yet. But one thing that I was interested in is how large is this effect from binary black hole mergers? So how does it work for binary black hole mergers? Let me just sketch out what the Newtonian expectation one would have for this effect. So again, if you have this simple picture of a binary, as it decreases from large separation to small separation, some angular momentum per solid angle is radiated, and it just goes like the square root of the separation times some combination of the masses. If you do the post-Newtonian calculation, you find that this time integral of the strain here, which appears in the cross polarization for this mode, it turns out that it is just as what you'd expect in the Newtonian expectation. It goes like 1/ distance times the net change in the angular momentum. But the fact that it's radiated with some non-trivial angular pattern across the sky, the angular momentum flux, leads to this kind of spin memory effect. And it turns out that this part of the strain, there is some part of the strain that generates this, and it had been computed before, many years before, a dozen years before, but it just wasn't interpreted as being related to the spin memory. So LIGO, cannot easily measure this quantity, but it can measure this strain. So one can, repeat this exercise, of, what is the part of the signal that's responsible for producing the spin memory effect? And for a system like GW150914, this black curve shows what my analytical estimate for it is, and the red curve shows, a typical numerical relativity simulations output for the system. So in other words, since this effect is something that, you know, peaks and then goes to zero, you're not really looking for something like a constant offset. You're just looking for something like an additional small, say half cycle of gravitational waves that, you know, isn't being modeled in the current waveforms. But, you know, this is just some signal, and one can ask what the signal to noise of this is. And I'll jump immediately to third generation detectors because it turns out to be exceedingly small in LIGO. But using this. Do you have a question
about the previous slide? So I'm guessing it's the same as the for the translation memory effect, that the Newtonian approximation is completely off compared to the what's happening, mostly comes from the merger.
That's right, yeah. So the Newtonian part would be, you know, somewhere at this early stage that where there's essentially no effect. And then this part right here is the merger around time two. So yeah, all your signal comes from the merger basically. Okay, so for the spin memory, like I was saying, it's quite a bit weaker. So these yellow stars are again the current detections, and the top panel is now Einstein Telescope. The bottom is Cosmic Explorer. So as one can see, you know, in this conservative estimate, it's unlikely that one would have a single event where the signal to noise is high enough to detect it. So in principle, I think one would have to play the game where, you know, you attempt to stack multiple detections and try to accumulate signal to noise for this effect over long periods of time. This is something that's sort of in progress, and I don't have the result yet for, you know, how likely this is, how many years of these detector times you need. But it's something that I'm considering, and, you know, but I don't have the answer yet. Okay, and then one can, you know, play the same game for Lisa, and, you know, again, instead of showing it versus redshift, I'm just showing it versus luminosity distance, because it's no longer really the case that you can, you know, detect this to high cosmological distances. So if one were lucky enough to have an event, you know, of 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes merging within a few gigaparsecs, one could detect it. But, you know, based on current estimates of the populations, I think this is relatively unlikely. So the slightly more promising approach, I think, is the stacking approach in third generation detectors. So taking advantage of statistics. I'm running a bit late. So I'll say a few words about this center of mass memory effect. So just as there were memory effects related to these super spin charges, it turns out there's also memory effects related to these super center of mass charges. And again, they are memory effects in the time integral of the strain. And it turns out that the form of these charges goes roughly like the mass times the memory effect. So basically any source of gravitational wave memory will produce this center of mass memory effect. So this is an interesting feature. There's a big question mark about how you can compute it through massless fields, though you can indeed compute it from gravitational waves. And I'll now give sort of this Newtonian intuition is getting less and less Newtonian, but you know, from the charges, essentially what you can see is that the effect goes like mass times this change in the accumulation of the memory effect as a function of time with some non-trivial sky pattern. And the part from the fluxes, so here to, you know, change your center of mass position, you need to actually radiate some linear momentum too, which only happens when you have unequal mass systems. So there's some complicated expression for this, but it's basically just proportional to the mass difference. And again, it's not something, this time integral, this strain is not something one can directly measure with LIGO, but one can think about trying to measure, you know, the corresponding piece of the strain that produces this effect, you know, which again would be some sort of effect that produces just, you know, a half cycle, an additional half cycle of gravitational waves. But if you actually think about the post-Newtonian order of these effects, this charge part is sort of a fourth post-Newtonian order effect in the waveform, which hasn't been computed yet. And this flux part is lower post-Newtonian order, but it's it turns out it's not, it's an oscillatory part. So it's quite hard to distinguish from just, you know, standard oscillatory parts of the waveform. So due to this fact, the, you know, both of these effects would be quite hard to detect. You know, at least for the 4PN effect, it's, you know, the detection prospects are, you know, quite pessimistic because it turns out to be in practice quite a bit weaker. Some of these, you know, smallish coefficients, you pay a big penalty. So it's yeah, weaker than one might think. Okay, so how am I doing on time?
We have three more minutes.
Three more minutes. Okay, so then I think most likely
Do you mind if I steal some of that time to ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So there's a conceptual point here that I'm confused about. So when you were talking about the enlarged BMS group, and I really don't know anything about this, so you sort of presented it as if those extended symmetries were tentative, or at least they were proposed, not, I mean, so I took this as meaning that they're not necessarily true symmetries, but what you're saying here is that, well, they still have a memory association and some real, you know, detectable, measurable physics associated with it. So is it, you know, is it just interpretation? I mean, the waveforms are the waveforms, right? Just trying to associate a symmetry to a specific, you know, piece of the waveform? Is that the, you know, is that the way I should understand this?
Yeah, so the argument I was making was that, yeah, I mean, I think there's more and more evidence for these being true symmetries, but there still are some holdouts, which is why I'm, you know, saying this in a more tentative way. So that's, you know, the first part of your question. The second part is, you know, in some sense, these flux balance equations, you know, they don't really contain, you know, I mean, in some sense, they're equivalent to the Einstein equations. So if you just believe the Einstein equations, you know, and that's all you want to believe, then you can just, you know, compute these memory effects directly from the Einstein equations. And, you know, the thing that's subtle about the memory is that, you know, it really is related to the fact that the frames are super translated at early and late times. So what you would call, you know, the preferred canonical frame at early times differs from the one at late times by super translation. And that turns out not to be the case for binary black hole systems for these super Lorentz transformations. You wouldn't say that the memory effect is due to the fact that the, you know, final frame is super boosted or super rotated from the initial frame. There just turns out to be this additional sort of subleading subtle memory effect that is, you know, not directly related to this, you know, to the symmetries themselves. So in some sense, you know, what I'm computing here is just something that follows from Einstein's equations in that sense. So there's not this additional layer that it really is and some can be interpreted as connected to the symmetry or, you know, the two frames being different by some symmetry.
Okay, but there's still some association you can make to those, to the enlarged BMS group. I mean, that's what I understood from what you said previously.
That's right. I mean, so the way I'm phrasing things is I'm computing this from the, you know, the flux of these charges. You can define these charges, they're finite. And you can, you know, compute, you can enforce basically that you have to have this charge conservation. And then from this, you can compute, you know, what this new memory effect must be, like the spin memory or center of mass memory effect. So that's the way I'm computing it, but I could have, you know, also just said I'll compute it directly from the Einstein equations, right? Because in that sense, they're equivalent.
Right. So yeah, good. Okay. I think it's clear now. Thanks.
Can I ask David? Sorry, a follow up to that. So, I mean, you're right. We agree that you said so the waveforms are the waveforms and the Einstein equations. You believe it's all here, but in particular, it's not. I don't know, at least it's not obvious that one would be looking for a charge associated to the time iterated strain. So there is some, of course, information is there in the Einstein equations, but if you didn't know, if you didn't think of iterating the strain, you probably wouldn't have picked it up, right? I have two associated questions to that. Mm-hmm. So is there a possibility that by considering double integrals of time of the strain, there will be further charges? And even if not, but mm-hmm. now we have take the strain, which is the observable, then you iterate it once, and there is another charge. Mm-hmm. Is gravity special in this regard? Because if we go to electromagnetism, we also have charges there, and we can also make an argument that is similar to the ones you're making here. Mm-hmm. Are there charges that we miss on the electromagnetic front that would be the integrated whatever of some something related to the field?
So let me talk about the first question, since I actually have a slide about that. So since I'm running out of time, I won't go into details, but basically, you know, the short summary, let's say, is that, you know, if you want to measure these memory effects, essentially what you're measuring is geodesic deviation. So you're measuring integrals of the Riemann tensor along two nearby world lines. So the summary sort of is that if you measure the memory effect, you're just measuring what is this relative change due to an initial separation, but no velocity. And that gives you the standard memory. If you mm-hmm. have some initial relative velocity, then you can have some piece of this geodesic deviation that contains these spin and center of mass memory effects. And then if you have this acceleration, this relative acceleration, you have then sort of four integrals of Riemann, so two integrals of strain. And I mean, there definitely are effects you can measure. Whether they're connected to symmetries or not is less clear. I mean, there's some people who think about some of these so-called subleading symmetries. I haven't fully understood this literature, but I think there may be some connection. But this is something that, you know, is under investigation at the moment. It's something that we're thinking about, but I don't have the answer yet. This is sort of at least the framework in which one might think about this.
Thank you.
Okay, and then, yeah, I forgot the second part of your question.
Have we missed charges in electrodynamics?
Oh yeah, electrodynamics, that's right. Yeah. So there are these so-called large gauge transformations which produce an electromagnetic memory. And this electromagnetic memory, you can think of just as, you know, producing a relative, if you have a test charge and you have some electromagnetic waves going out, then if you just integrate the Lorentz force equation, generically you'll have some sort of kick of this test particle. It would just be a kick of this test particle. And then you can think of, you know, sort of subleading effects. So there's some kind of, you know, in terms of the symmetries, it's what people call these overleading symmetries. So there are ones that technically diverge as you go to null infinity. And, you know, in terms of, I guess, the Maxwell equations, they lead to some, you know, subleading effect, like a, you know, a small piece of the displacement. So there are these kinds of effects, but the charges are a bit strange. I don't understand them as well. So
there is
this kind of picture also in electromagnetism. All right, so I won't then talk about scalar tensor theories. So then maybe let me just sort of give what the summary of what I've aimed to describe in this talk, which is that there is this gravitational wave memory effect from binary black holes. It's something that LIGO, more likely A+1 principle measure, it's going to tell us about BMS symmetry and supermomentum balance, and third generation detectors like Cosmic Explorer, Einstein Telescope, and LISO will study it precisely. There are these two new kinds of memory effects which were discovered from thinking about charge conservation, and although, you know, as there's been some discussion, it's not the only way that one can think about them. And they, you know, came from thinking about these spin memory and center of mass memory effects. And there's the hope that, you know, in third generation ground-based detectors, we might be able to build evidence for them through stacking, at least for the spin memory effect. And then I was going to say, yeah, I didn't get to the thing about scalar tensors, but there certainly are, you know, these additional subleading memory effects, and there's a fair amount, I think, that still remains to be studied and understanding these connections between memories and symmetries, and, you know, even new memory effects that are left to be discovered. So I'll stop here, and yeah, I'm happy to take further questions if there's time and people are willing to hang around.
Thank you very much, David, for this wonderful talk. We already had quite a number of questions, but please, if people have further questions, now is a good time. Luis?
Well, there, I think Hillary had her hands up before me. If not, then I'll go. Okay, I'll ask. Please, well, go. Given that you skipped through it, so what's the punchline of scalar tensors? I mean, that, I'm interested in what you had to say there.
So the punchline is basically you have an additional polarization of gravitational waves, you know, this breathing mode. You know, if you look at the asymptotic symmetries, this turns out to not differ from GR, but if you want to compute the tensor polarizations, the tensor memory, you can essentially follow the same procedure that you would, although it's quite a bit more subtle because your charges depend on the scalar gravitational wave memory. You have the scalar flux, and then you also have a tensor gravitational wave memory flux, which differs from that in GR. So basically, yeah, you have some weird, we've done, by we, I mean Shami Tahura, who will be joining Juan's group next year, so you can talk to her much more about this. But the idea basically is that, you know, if you assume basically that you're dominated by quadrupole emission and your dipole emission is a small correction to the energy flux, which, you know, it seems reasonable, at least observationally, given that we have good constraints on dipole radiation, then you have this weird sort of post-Newtonian scaling. You know, the dipole looks like sort of a minus 1 PN term of the flux, but then since the memory is Newtonian, when you integrate this minus 1 PN, you get this weird sort of log term. But it's, you know, so you have some weird kind of logarithmic correction to the memory in this approximation, but it's, there's, you know, it's basically suppressed by some small factor, which is roughly one over the Brown-Sticky coupling. So I think it's, you know, hard to measure, at least in the post-Newtonian limit, but, you know, that's true of all memory effects, that they're weak in the post-Newtonian limit. So if, you know, if there are simulations where, you know, you can, you know, get the full flux of scalar, the final value of the scalar field and the tensor field, then you can apply these balance laws and get more realistic estimates of, you know, what the memory would be. But of course, you know, these effects are typically going to be suppressed by this whatever Brown-Sticky parameter. So it's probably going to be small, unless you have some reason to enhance this and avoid constraints.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Laurent, did you have a question? I saw your hand raised earlier, but maybe...
Yeah, it was similar to Luis' questions. Okay. I wanted to know more about Brown-Sticky. Maybe I can add more. Is that I would expect if you turn on the Latong field that maybe you activate an extra part of the boundary symmetry, the asymptotic symmetry, which is the Weyl rescaling, which is just coming to light now. So maybe what I'm looking for is an effect which would be zero in GR, and then suddenly it's not so some type of observable like that. In the Latonic theory, you would have a new memory that is not possible in GR.
So I should say, you know, I have this as this one bullet point that there is this, you know, so-called, you know, scalar memory. So the memory associated with the breathing mode. So that, I mean, that in principle exists, and that's obviously zero in GR. It's been computed through 2PN order by Ryan Lang, and, you know, he hasn't found any evidence for it yet. But I agree. I mean, there, you know, there was some recent work where I think you were involved in it, maybe even that, you know, there is this dual two-form description of these scalar theories, and you can think about scalar memory as being related to some sort of gauge transformation of this dual two-form, you know, some large gauge transformation associated with this dual two-form theory. So, you know, I think in principle it should exist, but, you know, there's a subtle point that if you look at just binary black holes, they actually don't support this scalar charge and Brown-Sticky theory. So you, you know, need to have at least one of your objects have matter. So you need one neutron star, for example, in your system. But, you know, that's not a big ask.
Okay, any final questions or thoughts, comments?
Well, just a clarification, because you mentioned that it is true initially there was no, the spin memory effect was not really a memory effect, but I think there's a more recent work by Pastersky that shows that you can understand it as a memory effect, you know, if you go to his other type of gauge where you reveal that there's a shift in the subleading part of the rotation. So maybe.
Yeah, I was just going to say the way the first, you know, so I think about the spin memory in terms of geodesic deviation, but there's a, another way of thinking about how to measure the spin memory, which is involves the so-called Sagnac interferometer. So you look at, you know, instead of LIGO, which is just an L, you send counter-rotating beams of light. So you need a different detector configuration. But if you use this other alternate detector configuration, it turns out that basically you need to sort of have this alternate detector configuration, picks up a different part of the strain, let's say. It picks up a different kind of kinematical effect, you know, related to sort of a relative kind of rotation. And, you know, in principle, you can measure this if you have, you know, a properly rotating frame, although it's, since it's a kinematical effect, it's a little trickier to think, you know, how something like LIGO would actually measure this, which is why I always, you know, think in terms of geodesic deviation.
Maybe a last, remark. It's about the question of Eric, and I think, David, you were very cautious in the way you answer, but, you know, it's clear that, you know, these are symmetries, so you could ask why was it missed by the previous generation? Mm-hmm. And of course, the thing is that they are absolutely symmetry of the boundary conditions that you have to put there, and they are canonical symmetries. Now, previously, people were thinking of symmetries as symmetry that preserves a background structure, like mm-hmm. conformal, and they are not symmetry of that type, but that doesn't matter. So I think it's just that there was a risk, you know, to answer Eric, these are absolutely bona fide symmetry, and we understand them now. Previously, they were missed because there were some restrictive misconceptions about what symmetry could be. I think that's all. And yeah, anyway, so I would be less
political. Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm saying they're not symmetries, and people who think you have some null manifold and you have to preserve some structures, you know, background structures of this null manifold, they're not symmetries in that sense. But if you have a broader definition of symmetries, then yeah, indeed, you can think of them as symmetries.
Yeah, then I suppose it's a matter of finding some use for those, you know, extended symmetries, right? So if you have a new notion of symmetry, it better have some meaningful role to play. Otherwise, it's not, you know, it's not meaningful, right? But I'm guessing that in this case, there's some meaning to be extracted from those extended symmetries. Well, I'm not guessing. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it in the talk, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it is true. Another instances where they are finding a meaningful use is in the S matrix program, where now we know that the amplitudes of gravitational quantum or gravitational amplitudes have to preserve these symmetries, and that puts a lot of internal consistency constraints. So now you construct such a theory. So as usual, you know, once you have a symmetry, you suddenly have a wealth of new information about how to organize your observable, like what Luis was saying, you know, who would have thought that you need to focus on that particular observable and that particular observable is meaningful? Now we know it's because it's a charge of symmetry, right? So it allows you to pick.
Now, Eric, you got me. So do we have an example of a symmetry that doesn't lead to a meaningful quantity or concept?
I don't know. I was just saying stuff, but I guess for me, symmetry means, you know, you have a structure and then you act on it and the structure is preserved. And I guess so what you mean by structure might. Exactly. So the symmetry will depend on what you mean by structure. And so I guess it's true that some people, you know, the original thinking was a little bit sort of narrow in terms of what structure was supposed to be.
Maybe a better way to think about symmetry is in a thermodynamical sense, that is separating fast moving variable from slow moving variable. Like, you know, variable which are more resilient. So these charges, they change, but they don't change as radically as other, you know, combinations of the metric you would find. And that speaks to you.
Well, I guess I understand, and that's very physical. But so I'm in this context that David was mentioning. So these extra symmetries and extra charges, whatever is going to be put forward as saying, well, there is not a unique vacuum as you call it, Laurent. So there is where I'm trying to say that, and it's a very interesting idea that really kicks the desk of the standard law and opens a whole bunch of new opportunities. But then again, if one were to be on the negative side of that, I'd say, well, you were just looking for some names and some use for something that otherwise did not have a good use. So that's when Eric asked this question, I said, well, do we have another example in a different context where we have identified symmetries that were completely useless and there was nothing to it? So that's what I was asking Eric.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, if you think of all the, you know, all diffeomorphisms, right, as a symmetry, right? I mean, I don't think every diffeomorphism, for example, has some, you know, useful corresponding conserved charge associated with it, right?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. But maybe one final point that I should just say is, you know, if you just say did something like looked at the Einstein equations and the Bondi approach and then, you know, started integrating them, you could construct a spin memory. But I think, you know, one maybe useful point to say about these charges is, right, these charges are, you know, gauge invariant quantities. So, you know, if I just had been integrating Einstein equations and found some quantity, and, you know, it turns out this, you know, quantity, you know, doesn't vanish, people say, well, you're just looking at Bondi gauge, you know, that's some gauge dependent effect. So, you know, I think one very useful thing about these charges is that they are some, you know, gauge invariant quantity, and that, you know, allowed one to realize that, you know, indeed, these are, you know, some sort of physical observable. And then, you know, ultimately you can go through and look at geodesic deviation and, you know, just integrate Einstein equations and understand it in this language. But, you know, definitely the symmetries, the fact that there were these symmetries and conserved quantities, I think, you know, was quite useful in establishing the reality, you know, of these subleading weaker memory effects. So that's maybe just one, yeah, final point to end on, maybe, unless there are other questions.
they tell you where to look. So that's,
yeah, exactly.
That's useful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, good talk. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for all the questions.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you, David. So if there are no further questions, then I guess bye, everyone. See you next week. Same time, same place. And thanks again, David, for a wonderful talk.
Great. Yeah,
thank you
for the invitation.
Bye-bye.
Okay.